How many have heard of the syndrome called FTT, as in Frank Tom Tom, FTT? Anybody heard of that? Nobody's heard that syndrome. Okay, it's called failure to thrive. Now you recognize it, especially those working with children, because often that's what it's applied to, is young children. And it generally means that they are failing to develop physically, failing to put on as much weight as they should, perhaps failing to develop mentally as they should. Now, it also applies to older children. Older children can be diagnosed as failure to thrive. And I read very recently that now the medical profession is beginning to use that diagnosis for elderly people. And, you know, to stay away from the politics of it, they're just describing an elderly person when he or she reaches the point where the body is failing to thrive and they stop treating the person except for palliative care. And, you know, just the doctors deciding when a person is going to cease living. It's not always disease that causes a person to fail to thrive or the progression of age. There's one very simple cause and truly a sad cause, especially when it applies to children. And that is the lack of human touch. Many children, many young babies, fail to thrive if their mothers or a caregiver, if a mother is not available, does not hold them, does not touch them. And research has found that even a substitute caregiver can add that by touching. I knew a lady who volunteered from one church where I work to go into the hospital to hold children of parents who are addicted to crack. And the children were born addicted to crack cocaine. And this woman, you had to be specially trained and approved, of course, but she would hold the babies. And that would help with their development, and that would help with them settling down. I'd like to apply failure to thrive in a different way this morning. I'd like to apply it to the marriage relationship. Marriage and family counselors recognize that there is such a thing as failure to thrive in marriage. That is, marriage relationships reach that point where the development is not progressing, and if it were like an elderly person, well, there's no point in continuing. And that's what happens with couples who are not committed religiously to the idea that marriage is a lifelong commitment. If to them, without a conviction for morals or without a conviction to a personal faith, they go to the divorce courts and, oh well, you know, I anticipated that divorce would happen anyway, they might say, and they end the marriage at that point with divorce. But then there are a lot of people, not only in the Church of God, but a lot of people who are committed to their religion due to faith. And they believe that marriage should be for life. However, also among these couples, and actually research shows that the percentage is the same among people who are committed religiously and people who have no particular religious commitment. You have this development where the marriage turns dull, dead, failure to thrive. And in the cases where people are committed to each other religiously, believing that marriage should stay on forever, they stay together. They remain together, albeit they remain unhappy. Can that happen in the Church of God? Yes, it can, and yes, it has. I have seen situations and dealt with them where they have. Is it happening in any of our marriages? The question that I'd like us to ask ourselves today. What makes for a healthy marriage relationship anyway? How can you tell if yours is slipping into FTT? Or maybe you're thinking already, oh no, he's talking about me. No, I'm not talking about any particular couple. There is a proverb that says, marrying does not make a marriage. What? I'm married, therefore do not have a marriage. No, marrying does not make a marriage. Well, what does make a marriage? What makes a relationship thrive? And on the counterpart, what would make a relationship fail to thrive? Let's identify the factors that can build or break down a marriage relationship. And in the course of doing so, we're going to analyze some biblical examples And then we're going to talk about the dynamics that build solid marriage relationships and can actually bring life back into marriage relationships that have begun to slump or have begun to fail. I'm going to start by putting seven elements out here, sort of like putting these words or concepts on the table in front of us so we see what we're dealing with, putting them in front of you mentally, verbally, so that you can have them in mind. We're going to be talking about these in different ways as we look at the biblical examples. All seven of them can cause marriages to be built up or to be broken down, depending on what one does with them. Number one, that which bonds a couple together, either for right or wrong reasons. And you might say, well, we're bound in the eyes of God on the basis of our faith. Or we knelt before a minister of God and hands were laid upon our joined hands, and therefore our marriage relationship is bound by God. Okay, we teach that doctrinally, but there is more to marriage than getting married. There's more to bonding a couple than just what takes place in the wedding ceremony. Number two, an optimistic or a pessimistic outlook on life. You'll see how these fit in. Number three, meeting each other's emotional needs or not. And what are emotional needs? Are we talking about women here? Are we talking about men as well? Well, we're talking about both. And what emotional needs are, we'll see. Next one, having and respecting proper boundaries. What are boundaries in the marriage relationship? We'll talk about it. Or not having and not respecting proper boundaries. Number five, giving verbal and nonverbal messages of respect or not giving verbal messages of respect. Number six, maintaining either a calm environment or contributing to a chaotic environment. Calm versus chaotic. And number seven, the expression of affection, physically and verbally, or not. Obviously, the or not is that which takes down a marriage relationship. Now, if you would, turn in your Bibles to Esther chapter 1, and we'll look at the first biblical example. It's not about Esther, but the one that Esther replaced, Queen Vashti, that I want to look at. I'm going to read to you from the Amplified Version through most of the sermon today. It's close to the King James and the New King James. As you look at the classifications of translations, the Amplified Version is actually a little higher up on the scale of word for word, a little closer to literal even than the King James, where you get into some variation or the meanings that are added there in the Amplified. But nonetheless, a lot of times it makes, especially stories like I'm going to read today, it makes them a little clearer. Esther chapter 1, verse 1. It was in the days of Ahasuerus. I actually looked up the pronunciation of this, Ahasuerus. And it actually was Xerxes in history. So I'll stick with Xerxes, and Ahasuerus I'll stay away with. Stay away from. It was in the days of Xerxes, the Xerxes who reigned from India to Ethiopia, over 127 different provinces. In those days, when King Xerxes sat on his royal throne, which was in Shushan or Susa, the capital of the Persian Empire, in the palace, or it could also be called a castle, it was in the third year of his reign, and he made a feast for all his princes and all his courtiers. The chief officers of the Persian and Median army and the nobles and the governors of all the provinces were there before him. He showed them the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor and excellence of his majesty for many days, even 180 days. So for 6 months, this party went on. took that long for the people to travel in and out of the capital, 127 different provinces. You can imagine, that this is the government of the provinces as well as the military supporting them. Imagine all the logistics involved in traveling into the capital for this party that the king was putting on. A six-month party. What a deal. When those days were completed, the king made a feast for all the people present in Shushan, the capital, maybe a party for all of those who put the party on. Both great and small, it was a seven-day feast in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were hangings of fine white cloth, green and blue cotton, fastened with cords of fine linen and purple or silver rings or rods, and marble pillars. Beautiful setting. The couches of gold and silver rested on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, which is a red marble, and there was white marble, and there was mother of pearl and precious colored stones all put together in this mosaic floor in the room where they had the party. Drinks were served in different kinds of golden goblets. Imagine drinking from something golden. I've had, and you've had probably, drinks, beverages from gold-gilded glasses or mugs. I personally haven't drunk from anything that is entirely gold, but that's what they had, golden goblets, and there was royal wine in abundance. I'm not sure I've ever had a royal wine. I've had some good tasting wine. I'd like to know what that tastes like. It was according to the liberality of the king. He was very generous with the drinks. But drinking was according to the law, which meant no one was compelled to drink. The king had directed all the officials of the palace to serve only what each guest desired. Interesting that he would respect that. Also, at the same time, Queen Vashti had a separate party. She gave a banquet for the women in the royal house that belonged to King Xerxes. So the women were separate from the men. The partying that went on was segregated by race. On the seventh day, when the king's heart was merry with wine, which means he was drunk as a skunk, he commanded Menhemen, Bistra, Harbana, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, and maybe it's Sarkas, I don't know. I don't know what it would be like to go around with a name like Carcass, especially today. The seven eunuchs who ministered to King Xerxes as attendants. He commanded them to go get Queen Vashti and bring her before the king with her royal crown to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to behold. Now, I don't know if showing her beauty meant that she was going to be, well, let's just put it this way, I don't know how clothed he expected her to be, but he intended to show off her physical beauty to all of the men, to parade her in front of all of the men. This was a failure to thrive relationship. I just want to talk about Vashti. Vashti eventually no longer became queen. She continued to live. She continued to have an effect on world history as you study history. However, she no longer became queen, which opened the door for the rest of the story of the book of Esther. But we'll just concentrate on this. To give you some background, from Barnes' notes, feasts on this extensive scale were not unusual in the East, that is, in the culture of the day. Cyrus, when he was the emperor, is said on one occasion to have feasted all the Persians, whatever that meant. All the citizens at some time had a party that was sponsored at the expense of the government of the empire. Later Persian monarchs entertained up to 15,000 people at their table. Obviously not at one time, but over a period of months like Xerxes did. Now, looking at the command to bring Vashti the queen in, this was not Persian custom, and I'll give you a little bit more from a different commentary in a moment, but had it been Persian custom, Vashti would have complied, but it was against the custom of the governments of the East, and certainly it was against the government custom for Persia. It is, however, and this is continuing from Barnes, not out of harmony with the character of Xerxes. Apparently he was a, quote, character. And it evidently related as, it is related as something strange and unusual. And that's why God recorded it in the Bible, because it was so strange and unusual. Now for the other commentary, this is from the Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's commentary, or Brown, I guess it is singular, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. As the feast days advanced, the drinking was more freely indulged in, so that at the close, it was usually marked by great excesses of revelry. A lot of people were drunk, and behavior became immoral and disgusting at the end. The refusal of Vashti to obey an order that required her to make an indecent exposure of herself, that's the implication, before a company of drunken, reveling men, was becoming both the modesty of her sex and the rank of her as queen. Now, I think it is a misprint here. It was beneath the modesty of her sex and her rank as queen is what it should say. Because, according to Persian customs, the queen, even more than the wives of other men in Persia, was secluded from the public. Public did not see the queen of Persia. That was the custom. So not only, you know, was it disgusting for the husband to parade his wife in front of a bunch of men, it was against the government custom and the cultural custom for her to even be seen in public. Had not the king's blood been heated with wine, the commentary continues, or his reason overpowered by the force of offended pride, his ego was pinched, he would not have perceived that his honor, or he would have perceived that his own honor, as well as her own honor, was actually what she had in mind by her dignified conduct. The commentators are saying that she was dignified, and if Xerxes had realized it, she was actually doing the right thing. And the story goes on, and she was removed as a result of the advice of all of these men with the unusual names who I've read to you. What bonded this marriage together? Well, the king's authority. We know how he picked Esther. He just, eeny, meeny, miny, mo. He selected the most beautiful women from the kingdom, and he selected a queen that he thought would suit him. So just on his authority, it could have been bound. Politics could have entered into it as well. A lot of times that happened in the empires of old, right up through relatively modern times. Leaders married people for the sake of joining allegiances with other countries. Many of the marriages of Solomon were done for the sake of political expediency. Also, there could have been expectations of other people. Many people get married for that reason. One family expects that its family will marry into this other family. Or one family expects to get someone from another family and bring the families together. What was not involved was any personal relationship between Xerxes and Vashti. Nothing is said about that. That's not usually done at the royal level, or it wasn't at that time. His ego was clearly involved, pride. Those things were driving his thinking. He publicly embarrassed his wife, and by doing so, he kicked over the normal boundaries of modesty, dignity, and respect. We'll talk more about boundaries as we go along. He was unfairly critical of her, verbally abusive, when he had forced the confrontation. He set up the confrontation, and then he criticized her for not coming forward and doing what was wrong. The environment was calm or chaotic, obviously, was the latter, chaotic. Why? Due to alcohol abuse, usually a major factor in marriages that are failing to thrive. He indicated no affection for her. He indicated just total lust for her physical beauty. On Vashti's part, talk about her for a moment, she did not meet his emotional needs. His emotional needs were he wanted to parade her in front of everybody else. Now, am I being critical of her for that? No. She did what was right. It was unreasonable what he demanded. Nonetheless, she did not meet his emotional needs at the moment. She did not respect the boundary that he established. His boundary was come here and come here now. Now, it was impossible for her to respect that boundary because it was unfair and unreasonable. But nonetheless, she did not respect the boundary that he set. She showed no affection for him. She did not, out of love, say, okay, I will come and parade myself before these men. And I will add, properly so, but just calling it the dynamics what they are, she showed no verbal or physical affection for him in this situation. Now, most husbands and wives are not kings or queens. However, some of the same dynamics that affect you and that affect me are involved with royal couples. And it's worthwhile looking at their marriage as an example. The next example I want to look at is actually a marriage of one man who's named throughout the Bible. and as is his wife, and his name is in Hebrews 11 as one of the faithful. This is the marriage of Isaac and Rebekah. And for that, let's turn to Genesis chapter 26. Now, I'm not criticizing, or let's say I'm not evaluating the marriage of Isaac and Rebekah in a freeze frame sense. And by that, I mean that just because we look at it the way it is in these few verses, I don't mean to imply that that's the way their marriage was from the beginning, or that that's the way their marriage was after this. But God gives us this window, and that's all I'm doing is looking at this window and analyzing what happened in this window. In Genesis 26, here's the setup, verses 34 and 35. Esau was 40 years old, so he took wives. He took Judith, the daughter of Beri, the Hittite, and he took Basemath, the daughter of Elon, the Hittite. So he married two people of Canaanite backgrounds, and they made life bitter and a grief of mind and spirit for Isaac and Rebekah, their parents-in-law. The relationship between the daughters-in-law and the in-laws was not good, and I gather that the parents were grieved as well because of the marriage itself. Now we progress much further ahead in time to when Isaac was old. Verse 1 of chapter 27. When Isaac was old and his eyes were so dim that he could no longer see, he called Esau, the older son, and he said to him, "My son," and he answered to him, "Here I am." He said, "See here now, I am old. I don't know when I'm going to die. I may die at any moment. So I pray you, take your weapons, take your arrows in a quiver, take your bow, go out into the open country and hunt game for me. Prepare me appetizing meat such as I love and bring it to me that I may eat of it, preparatory to giving you my blessing as the firstborn before I die." It was customary, it was ordered of God, that the blessing of Abraham would come on Isaac and then would come on Isaac's children. And Esau was the firstborn, though they were twins, and he was to receive the blessing. So this was kind of a ceremony that Isaac prepared in his mind, something that he loved and savored. He wanted to make it very special, so he asked Esau to do this. Now Rebekah overheard what Isaac said to his son. And when Esau went out into the open country to hunt for game so that he could bring it, Rebekah went to Jacob and said, "Come here. I heard your dad say to Esau, your brother, 'Bring me game, make appetizing meat so that I may eat of it, and declare my blessing on you before the Lord, before my death.' Now, son, listen to what I have to say and do exactly what I tell you. Go to the flock, bring from it to me two good and suitable kids, and I'll make them into appetizing meat for your father, such as he loves." Apparently, she was a good cook, and she knew what Isaac loved. She knew how to prepare food so that he would enjoy it. She knew how to mask goat to taste like venison. What a cook. "You bring it to your dad, he'll eat it and declare his blessing on you." But Jacob said to mom, "Listen, Esau, my brother, is hairy and I'm smooth." He didn't say, "Hey, wait a minute, that's dishonest. What are we doing to dad?" No, he said, "Esau's hairy and I'm smooth. Suppose dad feels me, I'll seem to him to be a cheat and an imposter," which of course I would be, "and I will bring his curse on me and not his blessing." But mom said to him, "Let the curse be on me, my son. Just do what I say. Go fetch." So Jacob went, got the kids, brought them to his mom, and his mother prepared the appetizing meat with a delightful odor, just the way Isaac loved it. Then Rebekah took her elder son Esau's best clothes, which were with her in the house, put them on Jacob, the younger son, and disguised him so that he would have the odor of the fields. She put the skins of kids on his hands and on a smooth part of the back of his neck. I don't know how she did that or tied him on. This seems kind of weird, but she did it. And so he went into his father and said, "Father, here am I." And Isaac said, "Here am I. Who are you, my son?" And on it went with a deception, and you know how it went. Jacob received the blessing. Now, should he have? Yes. You know the story. He came out first, and the midwife tied a ribbon on him to show that he came out first, and it was God's intent that he would receive the firstborn blessing, but he took it to himself. and there were consequences. Drop down to verse 32. Esau comes back with the venison, all cooked, smelling delicious. He comes into Dad, whose eyes are so dim he cannot identify people, and Isaac says, "Who are you?" And Esau says, "Well, I'm your son, Esau." And then Isaac trembled and shook violently because he knew, you know, something deceitful had taken place. "Who are you? Where is he who has hunted game and brought it to me? I ate it all before you came, and more importantly, I gave him the firstborn blessing, and even more importantly, it'll be done. He will be blessed." Once given, apparently, that blessing could not be taken back. I don't understand all that was involved. Perhaps Isaac realized God guided his hand. I don't know. But at any rate, what was done was done. Further consequences. Verse 41. Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, "The days of the mourning for my father are very near. And when he's gone, after Dad's dead, I'm going to settle this score and I'm going to kill Jacob." And in that way, he'd take the inheritance. Now, these words of Esau, her elder son, were repeated to Mom, to Rebekah. She sent for Jacob again and said to him, "Look, Esau is going to kill you. So now, my son, do what I tell you. Go to your brother Laban in Haran and linger there and stay there until your brother's fury is spent. When your brother's anger is diverted, he's going to forget all this wrong. Then I'll stand and bring you back here. Why should I be deprived of both of you in one day?" She didn't want to have them both die. She assumed something would happen with Esau for murdering him. And then Rebekah said to Isaac, "You know, I'm so tired of life because of the way that Esau married. And you know how things are going with the marriage there. And you know our relationship with our daughters-in-law. Oh, what a grief." And of course, Isaac would agree with that. It was an upsetting thing for them as parents. And she says, "Now, if Jacob does the same thing and takes local daughters, just like these Hittites, what good will my life be to me?" So she got Isaac to agree to send Jacob away. And that's when he went to Laban and the rest of the story and meeting his wives and concubines, from whom the children of Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, were born, and our forefathers, or the forefathers of this nation anyway, Israelites, came. But I'm going to talk about the marriage of Rebekah and Isaac at this point. I'm going to emphasize that again. At this point, we're just looking at, and let's analyze it. And that's again from a woman's side, or in comparison or contrast to Xerxes. Here we get a woman's side. In this case, the woman refuses to discuss her wishes with Isaac. Now, you might say maybe there was no communication going on. Maybe Isaac shut the door. I don't know. But here she crossed the boundary or made a boundary where one should not be. She blocked communication with her husband about what she felt. She felt that Jacob should receive the blessing, and she was right. She had a case. But what she did was not discuss it with Isaac. She's also controlling, and she's manipulative in order to cause things to happen. Extremely manipulative. She had no faith that God would cause things to work out correctly. And that's a spiritual boundary that she crossed. She used her intimate knowledge of Isaac against him to get her own way. And that's part of the manipulation. Husbands, wives, after living with each other for a long time, know which buttons to push or which strings to pull to cause a reaction, and can manipulate the spouse one way or the other if they are so mindful. And that way, she ignored his emotional needs. Emotional needs, how did he feel? He felt like a fool. He felt deceived. He'd feel horrible toward his wife. He probably felt angry toward her. And he probably felt angry toward Jacob and frustrated and discouraged. She ignored all of these emotional reactions that he would have. She says and does nothing respectful toward her husband in this instance. Emphasized in this instance. Lack of verbal respect, lack of physical respect. She instigates chaos or conflict in the family instead of a calm environment. Things exploded after the blessings were given, and one son literally had to move away out of fear of his life. I really doubt that there was much physical contact between Isaac and Rebekah at the time. certainly no show of affection. Now, we're told nothing about what happened after that. Perhaps things changed, as I'm saying here today. Things can change in a marriage relationship, and hopefully they did. Now, I want to look at a marriage that is, again, a bad one from the man's side, good one from the woman's point of view. This is Nabal and Abigail, 1 Samuel chapter 25. Abigail eventually became one of the wives of David. But we're not going to look at that part of it. We're just going to look at Nabal and his relationship with Abigail and his marriage. It was a marriage that suffered from failure to thrive. I'll show you how you can know that. 1 Samuel chapter 25, verse 2. Nabal is described as a very rich man in Maon, and he had possessions and business in Carmel. He owned 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he was out shearing his sheep in Carmel, an annual thing, very big project. I've been involved in sheep shearing when I worked with the ranchers in Western Canada. The man's name was Nabal, and he was married to a woman named Abigail. She was a woman of good understanding. She had good character of mind. It could refer to intelligence. It could refer to social understanding, her ability to work with other people. Certainly that comes out later. There are a lot of things that could be implied in that. But she was a woman of good character. She was also physically attractive. She was beautiful. His character is described as rough and evil. Not only was he rough and evil as a character, he was rough and evil in how he did things. And he was a descendant from Caleb, who was a great guy, and it's a shame that he had a descendant like this. David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing sheep, and he sent his men over there to get some meat. David at this time was hiding from Saul, who was out to get his life, and Nabal refused to give them any sheep, even though, as the story goes, David's men protected the sheep and the shepherds, as well as hiding from Saul. So as a result, David was going to kill Nabal and all of his men. Verse 12, David's young men turned away, came and told him all of this that Nabal said. So David said, "Everybody, get your sword. Grab your rifles, men." They did so, and David also girded his sword. He had about 400 armed men with him. He left 200 behind with the baggage, their goods to guard. But one of Nabal's young men ran and told Abigail, Mrs. Nabal, "Behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to salute our master, and the master railed at them. He was abusive toward them. David's men are very good to us. We weren't harmed. We didn't miss anything as long as we were with them when we were in the fields. They were like a fortress around us, a wall by night and day. And all the time we were with them keeping the sheep, that happened. So know this and think about what you're going to do, because evil is coming. It's determined against our master and all his house. He is such a wicked man. Nobody can talk any sense to him." Abigail hurried then and took 200 loaves, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already dressed, 5 measures of parched grain, 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes of figs, laid them on donkeys. And what a woman to be able to lay out a meal in a hurry. Obviously, she had servants to help her do that, but she was also extremely capable. She sent her servants on before. "Go on before me, behold, I'm coming soon." And she did not tell Nabal anything. She got on her donkey, came down hidden by the mountains so that Nabal wouldn't see her from where he was shearing the sheep. And behold, David and his men came down opposite her, and she met with him. And David told her, "It's been for nothing that I protected your lousy husband in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him. He's repaid me evil for all the good that I've done. May God do so and more also to David if I leave of all who belong to him one single male alive by tomorrow morning. I'm going to wipe them all out." When Abigail saw David, she hurried and lighted off her donkey, and she fell down on her face in front of him and did obeisance. Beautiful woman kneeling in front of you. Obviously, he would be perhaps somewhat embarrassed. He would not be inclined to take out his sword and attack her. While she was kneeling, she said, let this guilt fall on me, my Lord. Like David's going to blame her for what her husband did. Let your handmaid, I pray you, speak in your presence and hear the words of her. Don't let my Lord, I pray you, regard his foolish, and my Lord, she means David, regard this foolish and wicked fellow Nabal, my husband, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal means foolish or wicked. His name means a fool, and that's what he is. It's his wife telling somebody this. Folly is with him. But I, your handmaid, did not see my Lord's young men whom you sent. So now, my Lord, as the Lord lives and your soul lives, seeing that the Eternal has prevented you from blood guiltiness and from avenging yourself by your own hand, now let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as Nabal, or lest you be as Nabal. I'm reading this too quickly. Don't make the same mistake he's making. You're being saved from that. Now, take this gift that your handmaid has brought to my Lord. Give it to your young men and those who follow my Lord, those who are following David. And please, I pray you, forgive the trespass of your handmaid. It doesn't say her husband. Again, she takes the responsibility. For the Eternal will certainly make my Lord, David, a sure house, because the Lord is fighting Lord God's battles, and evil has not been found in all of your days. Skip down to verse 36 for further consequences. Abigail came back home. There was Nabal. And behold, he was having a feast now in the house. And this is not untypical. After the sheep shearing, usually there's a party for the shearers and the staff and the shepherd. And she came to him, and he was feasting like a king. His heart was merry, and he was drunk. He was abusing alcohol. She didn't tell him anything at the time. She waited until the next day when he was sober. How sober he was the next morning is anybody's guess. But in the morning, when the wine was gone out of him, she told him what she had done. And his heart died within him, the Bible says. He became paralyzed and helpless as a stone. Now, I don't know if because of the drink or because of his physical condition or because of a reaction to what she had done, his apoplexy or his anger, but it seems like he had some kind of a stroke, and he became like a stone. And then 10 days after that, God intervened and actually took his life. What bond held their marriage together? What caused them to stay married to each other? Well, that's pretty obvious. Nabal did. Now, we don't know how they got together. Marriages at the time were arranged. Perhaps that was the case. Or perhaps he picked her out when she was young, as a favor to another rancher. Who knows how it started, but we know what was bonding it together. He was inflexible, and he was controlling. Excuse me, I can't get that medication to go down. He was also paranoid about his authority. I'm in charge. Remember the servant said nobody can talk to him? He must have had leading servants as well as lesser servants. And certainly he had a very understanding and brilliant wife. She couldn't talk to him. He was very worried about his possessions. He was entirely negative. He could not see anything positive. All this good that had been done for him, how miraculous it is that through an entire season, a herd of 1,000 sheep or a flock of 1,000 sheep, not a single one would be lost. There's no indication that he cared for or attended to anybody's emotions, certainly not Abigail's. I can't picture this guy with any tenderness about him at all. He certainly didn't invite her to participate in this major decision, which would have cost him his life. He didn't say, Abigail, what are we going to do? You know, you have these guys who are running away from the king, want some meat. Should we give it to him? He didn't invite her into the decision, which was moving the boundaries that should have been. His boundaries were, in other words, whatever pleased him. He had no respect for the normal boundaries that would be for his wife. He was cutting and sarcastic toward everybody, and therefore, very likely, that was the way he talked to Abigail. The relationship was calm or chaotic. chaotic. And again, what's the factor that ensures the chaos? Alcohol abuse. A demonstration of affection is inconceivable from Nabal toward Abigail. Now, on Abigail's part, and you're going to say, well, Abigail was a heroine in this. But just listen. She countermanded decisions that her husband made. And by doing so, she crossed a boundary. She did not support her husband. I'm not being critical, I'm just stating the facts. Abigail's role was largely damage control. That's what she did as a wife. She smoothed over the hurts that her husband caused, which is typical in a failure to thrive marriage. The spouse, the wife, in a situation like this, goes around and calms the children after dad has been explosive and angry and abusive. I dealt with a counseling case about that just this last week. I imagine it was silent in the home if there were children or even if there weren't. When it's just Abigail and Nabal around, I don't picture conversation. I picture silence in a situation like this, which is, again, crossing a boundary by Abigail refusing to talk, but she's doing it for the sake of her own safety. The home environment was not a pleasant one. Abigail neither voiced nor showed affection for her husband, not in the private conversation toward David. She called him a fool, just like his name is. She conveyed no respect for him. If she had had feelings of respect and love for him at one time, his controlling nature crushed those and caused the marriage relationship to fail to thrive if there ever was a time when it could have. Again, I'm not criticizing her. I'm only relating what the Bible shows of the marriage, and she did what was right. I'll say that much. Now, let's talk about what builds a healthy marriage relationship. Point number one, just to make it easy to follow, I gave you points. Point number one, maybe you've been thinking about this all along and comparing it to your relationship, how much of a difference one single factor would make in all of these marriages, and that is conversion. If all of the husbands and wives in these marriages that we've looked at practice controlling their human nature, things would have gone much, much better in their marriage relationships. In Galatians chapter 5, there is a list of the works of the flesh and the fruit of the Spirit. Sometimes misspoken as fruits, plural, of the Spirit. That's not what it is. Works of the flesh, plural, but fruit, singular, of the Spirit. And if you look at the works of the flesh in Galatians 5:19, the first four have to do with sexual problems. That was written nearly 2,000 years ago. It's directly applicable today with the incredible emphasis in the Western world on sexuality. About young children all the way through to older people. And apparently so it was even in those days. Or is it also true that this is written because God knew the nature that Satan had corrupted humans to develop? God knew human nature. We have a series of articles on Life Open Truth about the works of the flesh. There are 17 articles. They go through these works of the flesh, analyzing how they develop and what you can do to counter them and defeat them. Very well written, all with supporting scriptures from the Bible. Excellent practical advice. If you haven't looked at them, I recommend that you do. Works of the flesh. Just look that up and you will find these 17 articles. I want you to concentrate, or for now, just to look at one statement at the end of verse 21 after the list of all of the things that have gone on. I warn you beforehand, just as I did previously, that those who do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. It can destroy you spiritually, the works of the flesh can. Well, I'll tell you for the sake of the sermon, the works of the flesh, unchecked, uncontrolled, can also cause your marriage to fail. So they're worth studying from that point of view. And on the contrary side, the fruit of the Spirit can help you remain faithful so that God will put you in his kingdom. They can also cause your marriage to be happy and healthy and cause you to defeat the failure to thrive factor. And as with the works of the flesh, we also have articles on fruit of the Spirit. We have 10 articles that go in detail on each of the fruit of the Spirit, and an overview article. So there's 9 articles on the fruit, and there's 1 overview article. And I can help you with your study on marriage and helping marriages stay together. As Psalm 85:10 says, and I'm just reading the last statement from Psalm 85:10. This is from the Amplified. It's also in the New International Version, I think. Righteousness and peace have kissed each other. A marriage that is righteous, in a marriage where both partners are righteous, the result is peace in the relationship. Righteousness and peace kiss each other. Number 2 thing to do, Malachi chapter 2. Let's turn there. You could say that this belongs under conversion, and yes, it does, but it deserves a separate category unto itself. It is controlling the self, or self-control. Self-control helps you revitalize your marriage or keep it from failing to thrive. Malachi chapter 2, verse 14, you ask, why does he reject it? The people of Judah at the time, why does God reject what we offer? And because the Eternal is witness to the covenant you made at your marriage between you and the wife of your youth, against whom you have dealt treacherously and to whom you were faithless. It seems that God is quiet. It seems that God is silent until people realize that, wait a minute, we're not getting the blessings and the benefits in our crops and our businesses and our country and our finances, et cetera, and our health that we would like to have. What gives? And God says it goes back to the home. It goes back to you as a husband, and it goes back to you as a wife and how you're dealing with each other. It's put from the point of view of the husband, but it's husband and wife make a covenant with each other. She is your companion and the wife of your covenant made by your marriage vows. Marriage is a covenant relationship. Did not God make you and your wife one flesh? That's God's intention, that he created you to be joined together, and it means permanently. Did not one, capital O, one, make you and preserve your spirit alive? Speaking of the human spirit, even in the Old Testament. And why did God make you two one? Because he sought godly offspring from your union. He wanted a stable family unit from which would come children, from which would come another stable generation, etc., etc. Therefore, here's the advice from God. Here's the counsel he inspired Malachi to give to the nation at the time. Take heed to yourselves and let no one deal treacherously or be faithless to the wife of his youth or to the husband of her youth. How do you take hold of your spirit or take heed of your spirit? Well, it means to know yourself. Again, back to who you are, what your tendencies are, when you're under control, when you're getting out of control, when you're living the way you should, and when you're not living the way you should. You need to be, in another way of saying it, self-aware. People talk these days about self-esteem. Well, you shouldn't be thinking of yourself less than you're worth, but you should be self-aware. You should know whether you're like Nabal or whether you're like Abigail. You should know whether you're being manipulative and controlling. You should know whether you're showing attention and giving affection. You should know whether your words are cutting or uplifting. Know yourself. Exercise self-control. God is watching our marriage relationships. Number 3. This has already been touched on, and I did not point it out. It's in one of the works of the flesh. You'll find it as you study that. But let's go to Luke chapter 21 and read it here. And I read this to you not long ago in the sermon about the bridge over troubled waters and a prophecy about the end of the age. And what's that got to do with marriage? Well, let's see. For point number 3. Here again we find, take heed. Verse 34, Luke 21, but take heed to yourselves, and be on guard, lest your hearts be overburdened and depressed, weighed down with the giddiness and headache and nausea of self-indulgence and drunkenness. And then it goes on to talk about worldly worries and cares pertaining to this life. I just want to zero in on the giddiness, headache, nausea of self-indulgence and drunkenness, or as the King James says, carousing, and that word means being drunk. And point number three, then, is substance abuse. Maintaining a relationship with God will help you avoid substance abuse. It's a major cause of problems in marriage. And I'll add watching pornography in there, because that's part of the giddiness and the headache and the worldly worries and the cares pertaining to life. Marriages in the church of God have been destroyed by one becoming addicted to pornography. I wrote I was counseling very recently with a person who became addicted to pornography after much reading and just could not stop, just could not get away from it, and pled with us for help to be able to change. And then at the very end of the letter, identified herself as a 19-year-old young woman. Pornography is an extreme evil in the present world, and it's very easy to become addicted to it. Pornography is like a fish hook or the barb of a hedgehog with reverse barbs on it, so that once it sticks into your brain, it just simply digs its way deeper. There's never enough. When you see pornography, you don't say, okay, oh, that's disgusting, that's enough. You always, always, always want to see more. It's one of the greatest evils that there is in the world, and it must be avoided. So avoid substance abuse. Number four, again, this might seem to be something covered in conversion, but it deserves separate comment. Manage stress. Why? Because under stress, the worst of you, the worst of me, is pressured to come to the fore. Under stress, does the best come out? Only if we turn to God and exercise His Holy Spirit. If we just let it go under stress, that's when the angry words come out. That's when the impatience takes over. That's when the grumpiness comes in. Manage stress. Here are several points, very simple, but very necessary for managing stress. Watch your physical diet. What's that got to do with marriage? Everything. Watch how much sugar you take. That includes drinking Coke. Just watch and be careful of your diet. Watch overeating. Watch your weight so that you don't become overweight. It affects absolutely every type of illness that you have. Your body needs certain nutrients and chemicals for your brain to function properly, and even for the human spirit to work properly with the human brain. And the physical diet has everything to do with that. Exercise. Whether it's all you can do is stretching, and stretching is a very valuable type of exercise, and anybody can stretch, even somebody who is bedfast, unless you're paralyzed. You can stretch your toes, and wiggling your toes actually has an effect on your entire body. Won't get into all of that, but I can tell you for a fact it does. But exercise in a way that's pleasant to you, in a way that helps you clear your mind, in a way that gets your blood flowing. Next, to get proper sleep. Don't stay up late playing video games or watching television or reading books or working too hard. Get proper sleep. It is a law, a physical law. After that, balance your work with hobbies. Spend so much time at work and then spend some time with hobbies so there's a change of mental pace. Or if you're retired, balance your hobby with work. So there's a change of mental pace. And here's a stupid sounding one to mention in a sermon. Drink plenty of water. The human body, the human mind, and again that affects the human spirit, needs to be hydrated regularly. Drink plenty of water for the sake of your health. Next one, watch your mental diet. This gets back to pornography, it gets back to television, it gets back to your entertainment, it gets back to how you allow your mind to wander, it gets into the conversations that you allow into your mind when you're in the presence of others. Watch your mental diet. So manage your stress by doing these things. We also have an excellent article on, surprise, surprise, Life, Hope, and Truth, Coping with Anxiety, which has several practical points on dealing with stress. Point number 5, be content with income sufficient to meet your needs. Is it okay to be wealthy? Yeah. And share some with me. But it's also not only okay, it's wonderful to have income sufficient to meet your needs. Most people live like this. They have this much income, and they live at this lifestyle. If they have this much income, they live at this lifestyle. If they have this much income, they live at this lifestyle. Most people live, if you're listening to a recording I'm illustrating, most people live beyond how much they take in for income. You want to relieve yourself from trouble? Live like this, where you live and spend less than what you take in. And that way you have some for emergencies. And would to God that He would always bless you with that. You should ask for that every day, to ask for your daily needs. Many a marriage is corrupted by a husband who feels that he just must have more, or a woman who feels that she just must have more, or a woman who is pushing her husband to have more and get more all the time, not satisfied with what you have. I want you to read Luke chapter 12, just one verse here to go with this. Luke 12, verse 15. He said to them, guard yourselves and keep free from covetousness, which is the immoderate desire for wealth, the greedy longing to have more. This is the Amplified Version, obviously, and it's another way of saying living beyond your reasonable means, living beyond what your provider can reasonably provide or what you can reasonably provide, because a man's life does not consist in that which is derived from what he possesses, or an overflowing abundance, or that which is over and above his needs. We live in a society that measures one's self-worth by possessions. So point number 5 is be content with income that is sufficient. Very important in having a happy marriage. Point 6, know and respect each other's boundaries. We talked about boundaries all the way through. I want you to go to Deuteronomy chapter 19 and read a statement about boundaries when they were taking the land of Israel. It's actually a statute, and commentators puzzle over why the statute is where it is. I don't worry about that. But it's worth looking at because it has to do with boundaries, and it might help give you a mental picture so you see what I mean a little bit. Because it's a very important element in marriage. Deuteronomy 19, verse 14. You shall not remove your neighbor's landmark, which means the mark of the boundary of his land. His landmark in the land which the Eternal your God gives you to possess, which the men of old, the first dividers of the land, have set. Don't remove the boundaries. Let me define a boundary. It's the set off areas that in which a person feels secure, comfortable, and loved. Now, what it's talking about here in Deuteronomy, it's, hey, this is what I own. Get out of here. I own this land. For each of us, emotionally, spiritually, psychologically, it's the place that is ours. It's our own. Now, here are some examples. And everybody is different. How does your spouse see a husband's role? It's different in every home. I've known children who've grown up in the same home and counseled them as each one has gotten ready for marriage, and they have seen their home and they want a home differently than their sibling does. What does your wife think you should do as a husband? What does your husband think you should do as a wife? Do you know that? These define the boundaries. You see, if your husband is not doing what you want him to do, you're going to be frustrated, upset, angry, going to lead to chaos, and so on it goes. There's a need for privacy. That's a boundary. But what's a need for privacy for your spouse? And when does your need for privacy reach a point of neglecting your spouse? See, there's a fine line between that which builds and that which breaks. Have your privacy boundary, but don't neglect each other. There's a need for companionship. That's a boundary where you're together and the boundary is around you. But at what point does your spouse feel smothered or crowded? Like, you're around me too much. Many a wife says that about a husband who first retires. I love him, but he's around too much. The boundaries have to be redefined. You need to be your spouse's best advisor. You need to give advice. But when does advice come across as controlling and making my decisions for me? How do you know these things? Well, marriage is a fine art. You really have to know each other. You have to be attuned to how each other is thinking. And frankly, the boundaries change with age and your health maybe even affected by different days. Things change. Humor is helpful. But when does humor come across as sarcasm or put down? We have to tell each other the truth. But when does telling the truth cause hurt? We have to be responsible, do our work. But when does doing your work cause you to neglect the emotional needs of your spouse? I got to work hard. I got to work overtime. How many times have you done that? How much time are you spending together? I got to do this job. I've got to do this project. How much time are you spending together? Now, on the other hand, each's emotional needs must be met. I have emotional needs. I want my emotional needs to be met. But where, when I'm trying to get my emotional needs met, do I reach a point that I'm forcing my spouse to work harder and to ignore her emotional needs? This balance between work and emotional needs, or doing the functions of the house and meeting the emotional needs, is a major factor in a home in which there is substance abuse, whether by alcohol or other drugs. Emotional needs, how much work is put in, how much one denies his emotional needs, it's a major factor. As I say, marriage is a work of art. It requires you to be discerning. It requires you to have intuition. It requires you to spend time together. And it requires, on both parts, a willingness to compromise for the benefit of the relationship, as opposed to compromise to be controlled by the wishes of the other. You have to compromise if you feel you're being controlled. That's not good. But if you compromise, you say, hey, that's okay. Let's not worry about that. That's positive. Number 7, master your words. Obviously, communication has to come into it. There's an old proverb that says, he who masters his words will master his works. Words contribute immeasurably either to building or breaking a relationship. What we say, how we say it, even what we don't say, these are all factors. Proverbs 25, verse 11 is one that you know very well. A word fitly spoken, it says, well, that phrase, according to the Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary, means spoken upon its two wheels, a word moving quickly on its wheels to the end aimed at the speaker, commanding his words with a happy adaptation to the circumstances as a charioteer commands his steeds. Well, that's a lot of words. But imagine it like this. Words that are aimed just like telepathy, so that my words can go zing right into your brain, zing right into your consciousness. Imagine having a command of words like that. And that's what the proverb is speaking of, a word fitly spoken. That's the kind of words that we need to have as husbands and wives. Philippians chapter 4, and we need to turn to this one. And I know I'm pushing the limits of time, but we're almost done. Philippians chapter 4, verse 8. How are you going to say the right things? Very simply, think the right things. If you don't, you won't. And Philippians 4, verses 8 and 9 remind us to think the right things. For the rest, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is worthy of reverence, whatever is honorable and seemly, whatever is just, pure, lovely, lovable, kind, winsome, and gracious, if there's any virtue and excellence, if there's anything worthy of praise, think about, weigh, take account of these things, and fix your minds on them. Practice what you've learned and received and heard in me and model your way of living on it. We're in a generation where, let me just ask, do we know what graciousness is? Do people recognize what's excellent? Or on the other hand, what isn't worth looking at or what we shouldn't have in our minds? Really, really give some thought to Philippians 4, verses 8 and 9, because from the thoughts will come the words. Don't underestimate the impact of routine words. You know that most of our communication in marriage is the routine words? That's most of our communication. Pass the salt. When is supper? Supper's ready. Did you get the mail? Is that communication conveying acceptance, affection, respect, optimism? Say, oh, come on, get the mail. Put it all together. If that's the majority of the words in your communication that you have with each other, if you're not communicating on the positive side, you are communicating on the negative side. Listening at the right time is also part of using words. Listening to your spouse, that is. And the last point is embracing. Ecclesiastes 3, verse 5 says, there is a time to embrace. The Hebrew word is habak. I like embrace better than habak. But the word in Hebrew literally means to clasp hands. There is a time to hold hands, and we need to be aware of the fact that whether we are embracing or not embracing, a dynamic is taking place. If there is no holding of hands, something is tearing down the marriage relationship. Some couples fail to embrace because they don't forgive a slight. It may be a real thing that's happened, it may be an imagined thing, but they're not practicing what God said through Paul, where he said, don't let the sun go down on your wrath. The Amplified says, don't let the sun go down on your exasperation, on your fury, on things that you're indignant about. Think of it like picking at a thread. If you keep picking at every thread, loose thread on a fabric, pretty soon your sleeve's going to go away or the fabric's going to fall apart. If we are unforgiving about the intended or unintended slights in marriage, and if we let the sun go down, if we carry things from the day into the evening time, not even overnight, but into the evening time, it will affect the marriage relationship. Now, habak, embrace, takes many forms. A hug, holding hands, an affectionate pat, obviously a kiss. Sometimes sitting side by side is a show of affection. Sometimes just a touch. You're talking with each other, you reach out and you touch your partner's arm or hand. By the way, habak also includes marital intimacy. That's included in embrace. By touching in small ways and touching often in any of these ways, we're conveying affection, we're conveying concern, we're conveying attention. We're conveying security, comfort. We're conveying that our spouse is worth something to us. We're conveying calmness to the environment. We're conveying peace. And conversely, we convey the opposite if we don't do it. You know, one of the biggest reasons for lack of intimacy in marriage these days that young couples say? Work. They're too busy. They're too tired from work. I read a blog not too long ago from a woman who was affected by a physical ailment, and that kept her from being intimate with her husband, even being touched. She was in so much pain. So they created the 20-minute rule. Either one can declare at any time 20 minutes. And when they declare 20 minutes, they go and they lay down side by side in bed. Just talk. Now, if intimacy occurs eventually, fine. If it doesn't, fine. But they make sure that they are spending time with each other. It's an interesting concept, especially in a world when couples find that they just don't have time for havak. It's always time to embrace, according to Ecclesiastes. Well, remember then, marrying does not make a marriage. Said another way, just because we are in the Church of God and just because our faith binds us, or maybe a minister laid hands on our hands and says God binds us, marriage does not necessarily mean that our marriage is thriving. What happens in our marriage, whether we have a marriage, depends on what we say, what we don't say, every day, after day, after day, after day.